Reading this morning from Canto 3, Chapter 21, and there's a whole series of verses without purport, so we'll see how far we get. Starting with text 35. The setting is very early in creation, where one of the direct sons of Lord Brahma, Kartika Muni, under the order of his father, has undergone austerities, following the process of Yuga Dharma, meditation upon the personality of Godhead, very intently and intensely, and over an extended period of time, he carefully observed all the standards and with great devotion petitioned the Supreme Lord so that he could be qualified to assist his father carrying out the service given of filling up the planet or populating the universe with praja. Lord Vishnu appeared on the back of Garuda. They had some wonderful exchange. Vishnu told him what was going to happen next. It says, desires would be fulfilled. Swayamvamana would soon come with his wife, and they were going to propose marriage to their daughter. She's a qualified girl, as qualified as you. Together you will marry 9 daughters, 1 son. I will appear as that son, because he also had vatsalya rasa, or the affection of parental relation towards the personality of Godhead. And of course, distilling down many things that were said. And then he left. And as he left, very beautiful description, the flapping of the wings of Garuda, was he heard the sounds of the Vedas, particularly the Sama Vedas, just for the flapping of Garuda's wings. And the Lord went in the direction back to Vaikuntha. So he's feeling himself most fortunate, standing in the middle of a forest, knowing what the Lord's intention was for him, fulfilling his desire. So many nice things are presented there. So now 35 begins. Then after the departure of the Lord, the worshipful sage Kardama stayed on the bank of Bindu Sarovara, awaiting the time of which the Lord had spoken. It was just 2 days later. Swayambhu Manu, with his wife, mounted his chariot, which was decorated with golden ornaments, placing his daughter on it with them. He began to travel all over the earth. Purport. The Emperor Manu, as the great ruler of the world, could have engaged an agent to find a suitable husband for his daughter, but because he loved her, just as a father should, he himself left his state on a golden chariot with only his wife to find her a suitable husband. Text 37, O Vidura. They reached the hermitage of the sage, who had just completed his vows of austerity on the very day foretold by the Lord. Text 39. The holy lake Bindu Sarovara, flooded by the waters of the river Saraswati, was resorted to by hosts of eminent sages. Its holy water was not only auspicious, but was as sweet as nectar. It was called Bindu Sarovara because drops of tears had fallen there from the eyes of the Lord, who was overwhelmed by extreme compassion for the sage who had sought his protection. purport. Kardama underwent austerities to gain the causeless mercy of the Lord. And when the Lord arrived there, he was so compassionate that in pleasure he shed tears, which became Bindu Sarovara. Bindu Sarovara, therefore, is worshipped by great sages and learned scholars because, according to the philosophy of the Absolute Truth, the Lord and the tears from his eyes are not different. Just as drops of perspiration which fell from the toe of the Lord became the sacred Ganges, so teardrops from the transcendental eyes of the Lord became Bindu Sarovara. Both are transcendental entities and are worshipped by great sages and scholars. The water of Bindu Sarovara is described here as Shivamrita Jala. Shiva means curing. Anyone who drinks the water of Bindu Sarovara is cured of all material diseases. Similarly, anyone who takes his bath in the Ganges also is relieved of all material diseases. These claims are accepted by great scholars and authorities and are still being acted upon even in this fallen age of Kali. I'm going to read one other verse describing Bindu Sarovara. Well, we don't need more than that. There's a whole lot of verses describing it. So, text 40. The shore of the lake was surrounded by clusters of pious trees and creepers, rich in fruits and flowers of all seasons, that afforded shelter to pious animals and birds, which uttered various cries. It was adorned by the beauty of groves of forest trees. Purport, it is stated here that Bindu Sarovara was surrounded by pious trees and birds. As there are different classes of men in human society, some pious and virtuous and some impious and sinful, so among trees and birds there are pious and the impious. Trees which do not bear nice flowers or fruits are considered impious, and birds which are very nasty, such as crows, are considered impious. In the land surrounding Bindu Sarovara, there was not a single impious bird or tree. Every tree bore fruits and flowers, and every bird sang the glories of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Those aren't just pious birds, that's pretty special birds. Text 41. The area resounded with the notes of overjoyed birds, intoxicated bees wandering there, intoxicated peacocks proudly danced, and merry cuckoos called one another. Purport. The beauty of the pleasant sounds heard in the area surrounding Lake Bindu Sarovara is described here. After drinking honey, the black bees became maddened, and they hummed in intoxication. Merry peacocks danced just like actors and actresses, and merry cuckoos called their mates very nicely. Then some trees. Lake Bindu Sarovara was adorned by flowering trees such as Kadamba, Champaka, Ashoka, Karanja, Bakula, Asana, Kunda, Mandara, Kutaja, and young mango trees. The air was filled with the pleasing notes of the Karandava ducks, plovers, swans, ospreys, waterfowl, cranes, chakravakas, and chakoras. Purport, for most of the trees, flowers, fruits, and birds mentioned here as surrounding Lake Bindu Sarovara, English synonyms cannot be found. All trees mentioned are very pious in that they produce very nice aromatic flower, such as Champaka, Kadamba, and Bakula. The sweet sounds of waterfowl and cranes made the surrounding area as pleasant as possible and created a very suitable spiritual atmosphere. Now some of the animals. Its shores abounded with deer, boars, porcupines, gavayas. What's a gavaya? A wild animal closely resembling the cow. Yeah. A wild animal closely resembling the cow. Gavaya. Elephants, baboons, lions, monkeys, mongooses, and musk deer. Purport. Musk deer are not found in every forest, but only in places like Bindu Sarovara. They are always intoxicated by the aroma of musk secreted from their navels. Gavayas, the species of cow mentioned herein, bear a bunch of hair at the end of their tails. This bunch of hair is used in temple worship to fan the deities. So that sounds like another kind of animal than, anyway. In India, there are still gypsies, or forest mercantile people, who flourish by trading kasturi, or musk, and the bunches of hair from chamarees. These are always in great demand for the higher class of Hindu population, and such business still goes on in large cities and villages in India. Now comes Swami Bhuvamano into the scene. Text 47. Entering that most sacred spot with his daughter and going near the sage, the first monarch, Swami Bhuvamano, saw the sage sitting in his hermitage, having just propitiated the sacred fire by pouring oblations into it. His body shone most brilliantly. Though he had engaged in austere penance for a long time, he was not emaciated, for the Lord had cast his affectionate sidelong glance upon him, and he had also heard the nectar flowing from the moonlight words of the Lord. The sage was tall. His eyes were large, like the petals of a lotus. And he had matted locks on his head. He was clad in rags. Swami Bhuvamano approached him and saw him to be somewhat soiled, like an unpolished gem. A purport. Here are some descriptions of a brahmachari yogi. In the first duty of a brahmachari, seeking spiritual elevation, is hutashana, to offer sacrificial oblations to the Supreme Lord. Those engaged in brahmacharya cannot sleep until 7 or 9 o'clock in the morning. They must rise early in the morning, at least 1.5 hours before the sun rises, and offer oblations. Or in this age, they must chant the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna. As referred to by Lord Chaitanya, kalo nasteva 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 gatir anyata. There is no other alternative in this age to chanting the holy name of the Lord. The brahmachari must rise early in the morning and after placing himself should chant the holy name of the Lord. From the very features of the sage, it appeared that he had undergone great austerities. This is the sign of one observing brahmacharya, the vow of celibacy. If one lives otherwise, it will be manifest in the lust visible in his face and body. The word vidyotamanam indicates that the brahmachari feature showed in his body. That is certified. That is the certificate that one has undergone great austerity in yoga, a drunkard, or smoker, or sex monger can never be eligible to practice yoga. Generally, yogis look very skinny because of their not being comfortably situated. But Kardamuni was not emaciated, for he had seen the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. Here, the word snigdha-pa-gavalokanat means that he was fortunate enough to see the Supreme Lord face to face. He looked healthy because he had directly received the nectarine sound vibrations from the lotus lips of the Personality of Godhead. Similarly, one who hears the transcendental sound vibration of the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, also improves in health. We've actually seen that many brahmacharis and grihasthas connected with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness have improved in health, and the luster has come to their faces. It is essential that a brahmachari engaged in spiritual advancement look very healthy and lustrous. The comparison of the sage to an unpolished gem is very appropriate. Even if a gem just taken from a mine looks unpolished, the luster of the gem cannot be stopped. Similarly, although Kardama was not properly dressed and his body was not properly cleansed, his overall appearance was gem-like. Thinking of this phrase Prabhupada would sometimes refer to, you can't judge a book by its cover. Well, the marketing, they want us to judge the book by its cover. In worldly matters, covers or appearances of things are maybe more important, considered more important than the contents. And there are standard ways that conventionally Vaishnavas appear for sake of giving an impression of the Personality of Godhead. Vaishnavas dress a certain way, wear tilak, and for men, keep shaven face. I spoke with one brahmachari the other day, expressing that he was, I don't know why, not overly busy, but he wasn't shaving. And I explained that Prabhupada said we should shave daily for the purpose of preaching. Although, outside of ISKCON and, you know, in various places and ways, beards and hair is something that somehow makes people think this is a sadhu or something like that as part of the profile. Prabhupada said otherwise. I'm speaking now on appearances, a little bit like a detail, but we should get very, very clear instructions about how one should dress. And the wearing of tilak is subjective, and it's also interpersonal. Subjective is marking the body with the symbols of Vishnu while chanting the mantra Om Keshavaya Namaha, etc. It sanctifies the body, but another purpose of it is it reminds people of Krishna when they see tilak. Even if they don't know what it is, they know it's something in relation to God. I don't know if any of you go to work wearing tilak, but it's something that some persons do as a matter of principle. And after a while, people get used to it. You know, in the West, it's probably a little more touchy, more than probably. But I guess it depends on the workplace. But in any case, for reminding others of Krishna, that's like for our own purification and for reminding others of Krishna. We dress very nicely, not simply because we like fashion, but it reflects upon Krishna. I mean, in other words, the activities that we do as Vaishnavas is for the pleasure of Krishna, to help others feel disposed positively toward Krishna. And in other ways that are also external, like how we speak and how we conduct ourselves in service to Krishna, people will not be just attracted to us, but attracted to Krishna. Attracted to Krishna, his representatives. Important consciousness. In this case, kardama, beginning of Satya Yuga, there aren't too many people to give a favorable impression to. It's very, very, very early in the creation. And so his appearance is not so much a consideration. Specifically saying he's wearing rags with matted hair and the whole picture of a sadhu in the forest. Two things Prabhupada is amplifying. He wasn't lean and skinny like we often find and would expect someone that's living in such a frugal way. They will become lean and thin. It's described later that Devahuti, after staying with Kardamuni and for long, long thousands of years, also she became lean and thin, and her matted hair, she wasn't combing her hair, and just living as he was living. So that's common. And he's commenting twice here that that wasn't his physical stature, and the reason was he was nourished in a different way. He was nourished by the words of the personality of Godhead. Prabhupada made a comment once about Sanatana Goswami. No, Raghunath Das Goswami. We know that Raghunath Das Goswami ate very little, or so little that an ordinary person would die if you ate so little. You can't sustain your life, you can't sustain the body without nourishment for the body. But his program was a palmful of buttermilk every other day. I mean, what's going to happen to the body? Besides, you know, we wouldn't be able to survive. The body will become lean and thin. So a devotee once asked Prabhupada, was Raghunath Das very thin and feeble? And Prabhupada's reply was, sometimes his body would tremble. But what was sustaining his life was his spiritual strength. Wasn't the nourishment that normally sustains our bodies. His was his spiritual strength. That's what enabled him to do what he did. Saying the opposite. Unless one has such spiritual strength, one cannot undergo austerity, or one certainly cannot undergo austerities to the extent of Raghunath Das Goswami. So one of the things that's, I mentioned it yesterday evening, but one of the things that goes with spiritual realization is tapa, or austerity. Not austerity for austerity's sake, or not austerity for getting power's sake, although austerity may make one powerful. Commonly, austerities make one powerful. Look at Hiranyakashipu. His interest was becoming powerful. He became so powerful. So powerful. One little description I read of Osama bin Laden was that he would undergo extended periods of fasting as his austerities to give him some power. Commonly, at least like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So his extreme austerity, and not just how he did his Nama Vrata, but his observance of Kartik. When you visit in Mayapur, when you visit the headquarters of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you'll see the place where he performed his Namavrata, 3 billion names of the Lord. And now it's a stone structure, and then it was just a grass hut in the middle of basically a jungle. And day and night for several years, he simply chanted. This person, if we think we have active minds, his intellect was brilliant. He was you could say from a worldly sense, a genius. But with the capacity to undergo austerities like Haridas Thakur, it's inconceivable. It's superhuman. And his observance of Kartik Vrata, sometimes you see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur pictured with a beard, because I don't know how frequently, but it's part of his practice, at least sometimes, was he'd observe the practice very strictly according to the vidhis of Kartik Vrata. And I know Aindra Prabhu used to do like this too. Not shave for the whole month, for the whole period of 4 months of Kartik, and sit on a certain wooden platform, like one of the low wooden platforms, and put your hands behind your back when you ate, lean over, which means you scrunch up your stomach, and eat like a horse with your mouth. And you can't sit up, because as soon as you sit up, that's it, meal's over. And down, once a day. Khichdi with no salt. Yummy. And then up, and that's it for the day. And for 4 months. Try it for one meal. So they still have in his place that. So he's on a little wooden platform, and the meal is on the floor, so it's even, you have to lean down even further. Anyway, austerity is that's intense. It's not something that's part of the vidhis that we're to follow. And again, some persons do some significant austerity. Some, as I mentioned, I don't even tried that one. I know others without naming names. But so it's good for us during Kartik month in particular, the 4 months of the Chaturmasya, and particularly Kartik month, some particular vrata. It's not just fashion, it's spiritually beneficial. Mindful that it is being done because it's an auspicious month, and in honor of this auspicious month, and to enhance spiritual strength, because we need spiritual strength to carry out our spiritual duties. It gives spiritual strength. So, karma was spiritually very strong, although externally not kept well. So therefore he's described as gem-like. I want to speak about that a little bit. A devotee. We'll start with any spirit soul. Any living entity within has or is a spirit soul. So spirit souls may be covered and spirit souls may be less covered. When one takes up spiritual life and performs it sincerely and carefully and diligently, the illumination of the soul or spiritual consciousness becomes awakened. And there's a luster. Prabhupada would speak about this. Say one priest asked Prabhupada, "Why is it that I see that your followers are so bright-faced? And it's true, when spiritual consciousness is awakened, there's a natural luster. And the converse is also true. When someone is not doing well, their spiritual well-being is in difficulty, you can see in their face, not just only the face is the index to the mind, but the luster is gone. And I noticed this certainly over a period of time. When somebody is in a difficult condition, the language is used in the Bhagavatam, the blackened face, or the natural luster is gone. And spiritual luster, even more so, is bright. So, karma muni is being compared like that to a gem that's unpolished. So, the natural luster is there within a gem. There's one of the verses in Brahma Samhita describes like this specifically, that just as the sun invests its light in the Suryamani, a gem that gives off its own light, like the sun, but it's nothing but a part of the light of the sun, stored or contained within somehow a gem, and the gem is effulgent. Not just like when you put it in light, it will reflect the light of the sun very nicely, but self-luminous. So the verse is saying, just as the light of the sun is sometimes stored in a gem like Suryamani, whatever there is, speaking like Vibhutis, whatever there is within this world that's exalted, in nature, this is just an expansion of the personality of Godhead. We don't have our independent existence. Whatever it is that we have, it's borrowed. It's somebody else's. It's Krishna's. Whatever it is that we have, it's not ours. It's Krishna's. Whatever ability, whatever intelligence, whatever skill, whatever wealth, whatever health, whatever it is that we have, it's not our property, not ours. And it's not that we don't exist, we exist, and those things exist, but they exist in relation to the personality of Godhead. This is Sambandha again, taught and disclosed within the Vedas. But mind is Sambandha again. If persons who don't have that understanding, they're influenced by illusion. Maya, thinking, this is mine, I am this body, and this is my family, and this is my home, thinking in terms of a distant, essentially disconnection with the personality of Godhead. That's the paradigm, or the so-called reality that one functions with, and hearing otherwise is brings a reaction, what are you talking about? So, Kardamomani didn't have that delusion. He was Krishna conscious. And he was feeling very ecstatic, having just had the association of the Personality of Godhead, seeing him directly, hearing his words directly, receiving his blessings and his benedictions. So that's the scene that we're hearing as Swayambhuva Manu came with his daughter, seeing to his duties. One other thing is the scene at Bindu Sarovar, several verses describing part of hearing that description is it just hearing it makes the mind very peaceful. It sets the scene of goodness. It's a suitable, natural and a suitable atmosphere for spiritual practice. Ideal for spiritual practice. So, Prabhupada described wealthy persons, although they have the capacity to have these pious wealthy persons, although they have the capacity to have any kind of palatial residence that they wish, commonly we find they like to go to such places where it's very peaceful and beautiful and natural setting. Such places do exist on this planet, and from time to time, going to such places for a vacation or a respite, a refreshing period, it's sometimes done. But we're at the beginning of Satya Yuga, where the whole planet is more or less like this, because as the people are primarily in the mode of goodness, so also we're hearing the plants and the birds and the trees, the animals are similarly abundant in the mode of goodness. So therefore, flowers and fragrances and fruits and natural production that supplies to the pious people who reside there, inhabit the place, their necessities, and the animals and birds, their necessities. Behind our St. Louis temple, there's a parking lot. There's no lawn, it's just a parking lot. It's kind of urban. And in the corner of the parking lot, there's an apple tree. And it's really nice, because the apple tree supplies necessities for squirrels, birds. Down the back alley, there's a possum family. So mom and dad, the kids, come out and have an apple feast. You know, some fall from the tree, some are still in the tree. So the squirrels, or the whole like a squirrel festival up there when it's apple season. And they leave some for the temple too. They don't take them all. And the devotees from the temple make offerings to the deities. It's like a nice annual offering to the deities festival with that. Because here's this tree just supplying every year, supplying. So to give that tree the opportunity to render devotional service, It's not, in other words, it's devotional. It's how the devotees see it. It's a ritual. It's not selfish. It's devotional. The tree also wants to render devotional service. And the tree is given the opportunity to render devotional service because of the human species. Now that the other is pious, supplying necessities for others. The squirrels and the birds and the insects and the possums and whatever. And that's pious, just serving others. And the transcendental is serving Krishna. That's a special consciousness. One, so carrying bhakti has with it a special privilege, and it's also a responsibility, a privilege of being able, because of bhakti, to engage oneself and engage others in devotion. It's a great opportunity, and it's a great responsibility, engage others in devotion. Not in a controlling way or a doership way, but in a service way. It's nice, very nice. So the setting is there with the trees and the, everything we heard, the description of. Very sweet sounds of the birds, very pleasing fragrances of the flowers. And in the midst of that scene, Kardama Muni resided, and now he's being visited by Swayambhuva Manu. And we'll hear the discussion next. Any questions or comments?
Where is the Saraswati river right now?
It's not visible. I'm not a geologist, but my understanding is where it used to run, the riverbed is there dry. Is that your understanding also?
Yeah, it's dried up.
Yeah.
I mean, in spite of all the rishis doing so much of yajnas and all that stuff, why is it dry?
Well, what's on the other side of the river Saraswati? To say the Middle East, or, you know, some impious people were also nearby. And it's like, you know, the earth supplied abundantly, but the earth may also restrict. And having to do, as you're pointing out, with pious personalities. But there's also impious personalities on the other side. And if we were to do like a mathematical tally of how many pious activities and how many impious activities, what would the balance be? Probably be pretty heavy in the impious side. Even in holy places, there can be persons who are not sensitive to or tuned into or respectful of the holy place and do unholy things in the holy place, although it's a holy place. Yes? So some explanation. When the devotees in 1973 or something like that first went with Prabhupada to Vrindavan, 72 or 73, they saw a Vrindavan that's not as developed as, nearly as developed as it is today, but uncleanliness, hogs, open sewer gutters, bad smells from the bad sewer gutters. And devotees said to Prabhupada, this is so filthy. Fog and noise and rickshaw people and cinema music. And Prabhupada was very stern in his reply. He said, you are not seeing Vrindavan. You're seeing the covering. So, like, such sacred rivers as the river Saraswati, they may make their appearance to sanctify, but they may also withdraw their presence. At least visible presence. Anything else? Yeah?
A question on the same lines. Since we are practicing spiritual things, and there are a lot of sanctified places where when we go to the type of places, our heart melts automatically. It's still there, like a lot of places, like, you know, a lot of munis devoted their life to bring that spirituality in that location, to make that type of an environment. Whose responsibility is that to protect, basically, people who realize that that is a spiritual place and, like, we enjoy it, and then, like, who should be the real responsible people to protect that places?
The kings. Who are the kings? Who are the qualified persons? It's a both a Brahminical and a Kshatriya function. That's the answer to your question. And the fact that it's to the degree that it's not going on indicates the lack of qualification, not the lack of a post of someone that's doing something. There's somebody in a post that's supposed to should be, would be, but it isn't because their attention is elsewhere.
Also, it is actually receiving from.
Is actually what?
Receiving from the disciplic succession, it is nothing of more than strength.
Same idea.
Yeah. How do I carry that all the time? Like, you know.
Krishna consciousness. It's not a mechanical thing, it's a devotional thing. Shikshastakam 3, that's how you do it. And as Lord Chaitanya said, that verse is so important. One should wear it constantly around one's neck. Like an ornament of a Vaishnava is that verse. Because without humility and so forth, one will act in a different way and not be an effective instrument. So that's the solution or the recommendation of Lord Chaitanya. In that condition, we can chant the holy name properly. And when we chant the holy name properly, the strength necessary to stay in proper consciousness is with us. It takes strength to remain humble, take spiritual strength. Although one might think, well, gee, if you have spiritual strength, then you don't need so much humility anymore because you have spiritual strength. That's going to protect you. But the humility is one of those strengths. It's the protection from the onslaught of degradation from material involvement. Greed, pride, anger, lust, and so forth. Illusion. Seeing things in proper perspective. Balaram, as we hear from scripture, he's the original spiritual master. When Krishna is instructing Bhagavad Gita, it's this aspect of Krishna that is speaking. And the strength to carry out the instructions needs the strength, and therefore, in turn, the strength to fully realize the instructions. It comes from the Lord's first expansion, Balaram. Krishna is the source of everything, but Balaram is the source of spiritual strength for us. We need spiritual strength to carry out, as your question, carry out properly our duties. To receive that spiritual strength, there must be some humility, some willingness, some eagerness to remain properly guided and remain in a position of protection and well-being. Our strength is to take shelter of the Supreme Strong. Like that. The opposition is our own material tendencies, not something outside of us. The battle is not against some evil force out there somewhere. The battle is in here.